mention that I have a son named Adam Smith. So,
I will send him a sign.
I've got that on record. All consideration you're given, I give a fuck against the negative time. We have to litigate that in court. It's good to be here on this issue of takings, which has received a lot more attention recently. But I was noticing, I was a little intimidated before I was getting up to speak. I saw Fred with his computer here, and he had this little electronic screen that was operating, and notes were coming out of it, and I didn't really have that, but I did have actually an electronic device. Show you this, and this isn't quite as sophisticated, but this is a new technology we're working on at the court. It's called the electronic gavel. So we'll get this working here. This is in order to speed up our job and make the judiciary a little more high tech. So with one swing of the gavel, you can kind of communicate to the parties and give them some sense of where they stand. It's crude, but you know, the court is always trying to make progress. And it doesn't cost hardly anything.
Markets work.
I did also want to mention a story that occurred that had some relevance to what David indicated about the spotted owl concern. A fellow was brought into my court and was accused of violating the Endangered Species Act. He had been accused of killing a spotted owl. I said to him, that's a very serious crime. So I plead guilty, Your Honor, but before sentencing, can I give an explanation? I said, all right. He said, well, you see, my family and I were out camping, and we were in a very remote area, and we pulled our camper along a rocky ledge, and I and my sons had left the camper, and a great rock slide came up, destroyed the camper, leaving us stranded in the wilderness. All our food, all our supplies were gone. We were wandering, got lost. A blizzard came up. It was cold, and we were close to starving. We'd wandered for days, and we saw this bird. And with a stone, we killed it, and then we rubbed sticks together, and we roasted it, and we ate it. And I'm sorry we did it, but I would have done it again to save my family. I said, well, I can't possibly find any sentence against you. As we were leaving court, I didn't want to say it's in the record, but I went up to him and I asked him, by the way, what does a spotted owl taste like? I said, oh, it's about halfway between a golden condor and a bald eagle. Not to go to court, we're happy to get rid of the case. And talking about what we do, we actually do some work at the court. In talking about what we do, I thought it was very useful to look at an essay that Madison wrote just 200 years ago, a couple months ago, on property. Madison noted that this term in its particular application means that dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world, in exclusion of every other individual. In its larger and juster meaning, it embraces everything to which a man may attach a value and have a right, and which leaves to everyone else a like advantage. In the former sense, a man's land, his merchandise, or money is called his property. In the latter sense, a man has property in his opinions and the free communication of them. Is property of peculiar value in his religious opinions, in the profession and practice of them. He has a property very dear to him in the safety and the liberty of his person. He has an equal property in the free use of his faculties and the free choice of the objects to which to employ them. In a word, as a man is said to have a right to his property, he may be equally said to have property in his rights. Like the conception the framers had of those three words we hear so often, life, liberty, and property, was not of separate, distinct interests of which property seems to be in the modern age the least significant. But in fact, they really were a unity. They were different aspects of the same fundamental notion of integrity of the human person. And the three can't really in any logical way be separated. Our courts have tried to talk about the separation of liberty interests and property interests, and capital cases, they deal with the question of the right to life. those interests don't make any real sense when we look at the modern world, or we look at even primitive society. You can't live without property. Property is an inherent aspect of life, from the grain that you grow to make bread, from the animals that one kills and establish a dominion over to eat. And the ability to do that is part of that same transaction, which ensures life, for which you need liberty, and for which property is an essential aspect. So I think we've taken a constrained view of property. And in fact, often what we mean by property in the modern world is a very limited species of what the framers understood to be the concept. That being the case, however, I would argue for a somewhat not narrower definition of takings necessarily, but at least a narrower definition of what the courts can do in this particular area that I think is implied by the comments Fred had made. Well, I have sympathy with much of all of what he said. It seems to me that the social institutions we've created, or the civilization has created, and the framers established, are not up to the entire task. In fact, if we take literally that when you pay a takings judgment, you're talking about a taking itself, then we're essentially saying government itself has no legitimate claim on resources in any form. And that I reject. It seems to me taxing is not taking. It can become a taking, certainly. And I think there's been a significant argument that that when you're talking about confiscatory tax rates, that is a taking. But to say that taxes per se are a taking is really to reject the notion of free government. And certainly to reject the notion of any rule of law, which needs a governmental instrumentality to enforce that rule. Let me just define, I guess, what I do see as the role of the courts then in the taking area. And I think that has to be looked at a little broader than just the classic types of taking cases and the kinds of cases that concern the court. It has to be, in fact, looked at in some historical perspective of the way in which courts have tried to restrain government actions that affect individual liberty. And I perceive at least four eras in our constitutional history where government and the courts were attempting to come to conceptual grasp with the problem of individual liberty and government regulation of that individual liberty and property and the other aspects of individual fundamental integrity of the human person. The earliest era is the first third, really, of the 19th century, the Supreme Court of John Marshall and Justice Story. That Supreme Court attempted to develop concepts to limit government, natural rights, to be used at the point of pure, in a pure sense, was attempted. That really didn't provide an adequate basis because of the problem, I think, that the originalists have clearly and positively delineated. The natural rights view of some individuals are very different, in fact, radically different than the natural rights of other individuals. I don't want to repeat the first panel. I don't really think that's a critique of natural rights theory, but at least it was a limit on the court's ability to use the doctrine as a limitation on government power. The ex post facto clause was attempted to be used for a period. The contracts clause to limit state's power. Finally, the notion of vested rights, which became one of the more durable concepts of the Marshall Court, that government couldn't interfere with vested rights, whether because that interference would amount to a taking or interfered with some other aspect of liberty. Well, with the accession of Justice Taney and the presidency of Andrew Jackson, the era of the court's attempt to restrain government interferences with individual rights came to an end. The shift, as all constitutional shifts, was not radical and not immediate, but the Taney court was much more sensitive to popular sovereignty. The states were given a much greater degree of autonomy in interfering with what some might say with the rights of their citizens. On the other hand, we're still talking about relatively small differences in terms of today's over-regulated society. We're not looking at a particularly oppressive government under Jackson. Free enterprise was expanding dramatically. The Democratic majority was opting for individual freedom. But there was a shift doctrinally that was very significant. The Civil War and the post-war cases interpreting the 14th Amendment brought that era to a close. The slaughterhouse cases were the first serious challenge to state economic regulation, state economic power, based on the new 14th Amendment. It failed, but the strength and vigor and the membership of the dissent in the slaughterhouse case presaged a change in doctrine. And by the 1890s, the doctrine had been totally reversed, largely based upon the notion of due process as the new conception for providing a limited and a principled limitation on government power. In a lot of ways, the due process notion had really revived the idea of natural rights, but incorporated that in the textual section of the Constitution. That era prevailed until the 1930s. The 1930s have to be seen not only as a reversal of a specific set of doctrines, or any specific set of doctrines, but really a reversal of the role of the courts in our system. The courts became insensitive to human rights that could be particularly defined as having an economic consequence or market effect. And this isn't seen in just one clause. I don't think history of a particular clause or development of a particular body of law misses some of the drama of what happened. You have to look at the broad spectrum across the board, and I listed a few of these, and I don't think it's comprehensive. The Commerce Clause was reinterpreted to give the federal government a blank check. The Due Process Clause was effectively read out of the business of having any effect on rights that we would call economic. The Equal Protection Clause, likewise, suffered the same fate as the Privileges and Immunities Clause. The Contract Clause, taxing power, was no longer read as meaning something. It meant essentially the government could do anything, as did the spending power. The 10th Amendment was read out of the Constitution. And even the doctrine of separation of powers, which had on occasion been used to limit government power, no longer provided a substantive limit. And there are others as well. That era of insensitivity to economic rights is, I think, reaching its doctrinal end, if it hasn't already. I don't think we're in a new era yet. The era is developed and sort of reach a point of equilibrium where the new era is yet to be determined. But I think there's some good reasons for thinking that the new era may be more sensitive to economic rights. Largely because the connections that have been seen between economic rights and other kinds of interests in a complex society, the taking cases illustrate that those really can't be separated. The commercial speech cases, I think, were a very interesting development where people generally viewed as least sensitive on the Supreme Court economic interests were suddenly in the forefront of protecting commercial speech. It's interesting that movement has now begun, at least if not falter, it's in a state of some confusion. But it's very critical in an electronic society, economic liberty. Even in areas, for example, which I had focused on until a recent article, I know Henry Manning has, the area of securities transactions. We would contemplate prior restraint, something that is the most contrary to our First Amendment jurisprudence. But when a company wants to tell its stockholders what's happening in the company, the SEC has the power to restrain communication by a company to its stockholders. The area unheard of in non-commercial areas. That's part of what's making the change. Part of it is the work of the law and economics, the insights that's provided. Part of it is, I think, the political winds of the time. Dean Manning last night was somewhat pessimistic, having just returned from a trip to Africa looking at some of the new developments there. I can't find that pessimism, nor can I find it even in what's happening politically in this country, what I see from case law, people I interview for law clerks, various social developments. There is a failure and collapse of the order that says government can control the economic life of the individual. That collapse isn't total, that collapse isn't complete, but to misunderstand the signs of its impending concurrence is very similar to those, I think, who misunderstood the signs that led up to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The system that the 1930s New Deal jurisprudence was based on is rotten. It no longer supports a rational interpretation of how the world works. Close to the limits of my time, but let me just say two final points and maybe explain a little bit about where our court fits in the roles. David suggested that we don't bring your cases. I think first go to the agencies and then try to think of something else. Judges always want settlements and no cases. The traditional jurisdiction of our court, the takings law, really goes back to the period following the Civil War. And there are two distinct traditions which are intertwined. One is the regulatory takings tradition. That's the most controversial. That's the one where essentially the Supreme Court has not yet made up its mind as to how you draw a line between individual liberty and legitimate interests of the government. And they're very difficult. And they're very difficult problems. The very breadth that Fred suggested and can be argued makes it almost impossible to take. On the other hand, the regulatory taking area is at least focused in on certain areas. The first case in the area is 1868, where the government made greenbacks legal tender, and people held gold, lost a lot of money on them. The Supreme Court at that time, interestingly, first decided in favor of the holders of gold. On a rehearing, the court had a new member and one resignation, and it was a 5-4 decision against the holders of gold. And finally, the government could make greenbacks legal tender. About the same time, government had done things to people's property physically. The government was expanding, and people brought actions in the Court of Claims challenging those actions. And the Court of Claims awarded relief. And pretty much since that period, there hasn't been much dispute about what we call physical takings. The government drops a bomb on your property, or poisons your well by dumping a toxic waste on your property. Or even in Loretto, the government puts a little box on your apartment building to make a cable connection, which you don't necessarily consent to. Physical takings have a very different history. In the court, they're mainly factual issues. Did the government do it or didn't the government do it? Often it's rather subtle when you're talking about effects like pollution, water supply, or flooding, which we get a lot of flooding cases. Both the regulatory taking cases, as I think Roger Pillon's comment on Lucas, is the essence of really the problem we have. The Supreme Court has dealt with the regulatory taking issue maybe 8-10 times in the last decade and a half. The results have been anything but clear. If you look at Nolan, which was referred to the same year the court decided Keystone Bituminous Coal, which went exactly the opposite way, also by a 5-4 decision. And the trial judge, I'll show you the problem we have. The trial judge is left trying to interpret what the Supreme Court means. You think, you know, it's orange and a little pink and a little white. But then another case comes along and it seems to reverse that. By the way, I broke my shoulder, so I'm a little one-handed here. Someone told me recently that it was the right shoulder and I can't use the right hand. I have to use my far right hand for most of them. You know, you think you understand. You got the new case law now, and then you sort of, that one is going to be reversed. Wait a second. It's getting more confusing now. I thought it was, you know, you pretty much have it down there. And you think you've got it, and then wait a second. This is sort of continues to change. You're never quite sure what the court is saying. So now you've got it. Wait a second. You've got it now. There it is. There's the final decision. We got that.
All right.
It's great there. But let me just conclude by saying, in addition to the selfish reasons that the judiciary is not the answer, we don't want everyone bringing cases to the Court of Federal Claims, seems to me also in the form of government established by the framers, the judiciary is the backup. The judiciary can do significant things, and may well be at a critical point. Liberties can be defended to the point that the political system
ultimately decides it was wrong. But to rely on the judiciary for more than that, that second look, seems to me really an illusion. The judiciary cannot sustain liberty in a society where the people have lost the ideal of individual liberty. And the task that all of those of us who believe in the regime of individual liberty have is to make sure that the problem never gets to the judiciary, and to make sure that the society holds deeply within its heart the ideals of Madison. Thank you very much.